Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One from Eagle Speak, and appreciate you taking time this afternoon to join us live, or if you're cheating and getting the podcast, thank you very much for joining us and downloading on a regular basis. If you're with us live and you are so inclined, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you will find the chat room. You can roll in with the usual suspects. And if you have some observations about the show that you'd like to share, or if there's a question you would like for us to direct to our guest that you don't think we're quite heading in that direction, that's a great place to put it. We'll be monitoring it during the course of the show, and we'll be glad to grab that and fold that into the conversation. Now, if you have to leave and go take care of some honeydews during the course of the show and you want to catch up on what you missed, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or just take the shortcut and subscribe to the podcast over on iTunes or Stitcher. But for now, let's go ahead and roll into the topic of the day. And you can never go wrong with the classics, as it often is said. And when you talk about classics, at least in this line of work and the areas that we like to focus on here in Midrats, it's hard to go wrong when you're going to roll back the clock 2,500 years back to pretty much what many people consider the first historian, Thucydides. And over the course of the last month to 6 weeks, we've seen them continue to pop up in the news cycle as the new administration and those that watch the administration have decided that that's a good topic to bring up and talk to about how that can relate to what we're seeing today, especially when it comes to the often mentioned Thucydides trap. And we're going to talk about that and a lot of other related subjects about the old historian, but more importantly, how the ideas and the time that shaped his writing influenced our nation, our national security habits, and maybe either leading or misleading people in the decision-making bodies that are leading our country today. And we have a great guest today to discuss all these issues and other related ones, Corey Shake. And Corey is a research fellow over at the Hoover Institution. She teaches thinking about war at Stanford. And with our good friend, General James Mattis, she edited Warriors and Citizens, American Views on Our Military. Her book on the Anglo-American Hegemonic Transition comes out from Harvard in the fall. And Corey, welcome to Midrats.
It is such a privilege to be on with you guys. I'm a huge fan of the podcast.
Well, thank you very much. And we're a huge fan of yours. And as I was prepping, I was like, I kind of feel selfish taking an hour of Corey's time because she is so busy, but I could do probably 3 hours of the show. And
thank you for that. That's a very nice compliment.
Well, it's because when I read your article, and we linked to it over at the show page that you put out, you could tell that there's just a lot there. But you know, we only have so many words that we can run with, and goodness knows there's been libraries filled up with the topic. And that's kind of what I wanted to kind of start the program with. As the kids say nowadays, you know, let's look at the meta, the bigger picture. And one of my little personality weaknesses, I love old bookstores. The mustier and dustier, the better. And as you dig around in them, I look for obscure titles. And if you can't read the title on the spine of the book, I'm going to pull it out and read it. And and by doing that, I found the English translation. I think it was a 1923 imprint of Benito Mussolini's autobiography. But I also had, it's just a really, really neat book. It's a 1954 imprint of a 1943 summary. by, and maybe I should know this guy, but I don't. Edited by the is this distinguished Sir Richard Livingston. And it's a nice little 6x4 handy copy that I've read twice over the course of the years that I've had it. And what's neat about it is whoever originally had it back in the 1950s, this gentleman was Andy Taylor. His dorm room was 306 Morrow, wherever that is. His underline, which is always fun to see. And I wanted to kind of roll off a quote of his and use that as a basis as we start to talk about Thucydides and what he brings us. And Sir Richard, he starts off his preface in, quote, "It is part of a liberal education to know the greatness, the greatest things in the world, and Thucydides is probably the greatest of historians. The object of this volume is to provide a translation with such introduction and notes that will enable the person who knows little of Greek history to read him without difficulty. I have not attempted to supply a historical commentary, but to give the necessary help to those who wish to read Thucydides, as much of us read Gibbon or Macaulay, without going into questions that mainly concern scholars and historians," unquote. And I love that assumption that used to be true amongst the educated, that there was an assumption that everybody had a certain basic knowledge of a canon of historical knowledge, that at the best universities where one would hope those that would rise to decision-making and leadership areas would be educated, that they all had a same general understanding and basics. And one of the things that first came to mind when all this discussions of Thucydides, one was exciting that, hey, you know, let's all talk about the old man again. But also there was a lot of articles that you could tell were written for people or about people who are influencers or in significant positions who probably do not know Thucydides from a feta Greek salad. Talk for a little bit about this little renaissance we've had in Thucydides and what that conversation has kind of caught you about whether people understand it well or are misunderstanding it. And is this an exciting, reassuring thing for you, or is this a concerning thing for you?
So I think there are three strands of conversation that lead to this moment where everybody's reading Thucydides and talking about Thucydides. One strand is that the Trump administration has put in its most influential national security jobs retired or active duty military officers. And the military reads Thucydides, they study Thucydides, and in particular, in the case of Jim Mattis and I think H.R. McMaster, these are people who take their professional education extraordinarily seriously. And if there were only one book I could give anyone to understand military history, it would be Thucydides, because he's not so important because he was the first military historian. It's important. He's important because he was the best, right? Like, almost every dilemma that a society has to confront about waging war and suing for peace gets brought up in Thucydides over the course of the long war that Sparta and Athens fight. So the first thing is that there are military folks who take this education seriously in important positions in the Trump administration. So that's why, for example, Politico was so interested in writing about this subject, right? Like, powerful people who are actually knowledgeable of the classics. What does this tell us? The second strand is that it's Graham Allison, the Harvard professor, has written a book or started a project a couple of years ago called The Thucydides Trap. And his notion is that the lesson we should take from Thucydides is, as Thucydides himself summarizes, that it was the fear of a rising Athens that drove Sparta to war. I hope we will get to later the fact that almost all of the evidence Thucydides himself provides does not accord with that conclusion on his part. It's important to remember he was a participant in this war, not just a writer on it, and so had a strong Athenian bias and a strong desire to place the blame on Sparta for the war that goes on. So Graham Allison's project on the Thucydides trap, they did, the Belfer Center at Harvard did this big review of all potential cases of rising powers and how established dominant powers reacted to them. And Graham's book has just come out that, in my judgment, kind of breathlessly suggests that the U.S. and China are on the brink of war and only very careful compromise on the part of the United States will prevent that, right? So we're Sparta in his description. We're the established hegemon that will be provoked to fight a preventative war. And then the third line of activity that I think makes for this moment is that some of the most ideological and reckless people around President Trump, civilians, Steve Bannon, Mike Anton, profess themselves great fans of Thucydides. So Bannon is reportedly a big fan of the militaristic society of Sparta and a belief that, you know, soft democratic societies get smushed. And Michael Anton has used, you know, kind of which translation of Thucydides do you read as his sorting criteria for whether someone is a genuine intellectual. I have to say that last part really makes me laugh because I feel like that's pretty rarefied air, and that it's exclusionary, not inclusionary. And in fact, we actually want to make Thucydides accessible to as many people who will dive in and try and figure out what he's saying and figure out what it might mean for us all.
I'm
sorry, that was 35 too long an answer to the question.
No, it's perfect. I love it. As a matter of fact, I'm jumping in front of my my co-host here because I had a follow-on because it was a perfect setup. It was going to be a follow-on question. I think you'll like this. I want to go back to Sir Richard again. Sir Richard says something. I'd like for you to pull this thread. I think it's important, and Sir Richard sure thinks it's important, and here's why. This was later on in the preface, again, for the listeners who may have missed it in my rambling opening. This is a 1954 imprint of Sir Richard Livingston's 1943 edited copy of the Peloponnesian War. He says later on, quote, "There are three good English translations of Thucydides, by Thomas Hobbes, 1629, Joette, 1881, and Crawley, 1874. The first is best as a work of literature, but Thucydides in a Jacobean dress has an archaic air which may conceal from us how modern is his outlook and thought." Unquote. So I want to tee this up for you, Corey.
Oh, that's so wonderful.
In 1954, if Sir Richard said, you know, Hobbes' translation is not really what the modern person should be thinking, and I don't think very many people, and I barely have a grasp of it, of a Jacobean dress has an archaic air. What is it about that Hobbes translation that even back in 1943, Sir Richard would be telling people, yeah, that's great literature, but don't use that as a reference point? And here we are in 2017, we have people who are actually saying, no, this is your reference point.
Yeah. So I, too, really like the Hobbes translation because it speaks to its time and overtly. And I feel like every new translation just as every new interpretation of a Shakespeare play that you see put on stage, they always speak to the specific problems the society is wrestling with or the intellectual trends at the time in that society. And that is true of Hobbes. It's also true of Thucydides, right? Like, if you think about the way we conceptualize Athens, we think of it as the cradle of democracy, a vibrant, diverse, creative society similar to our own. That is not what Athens looks like to Thucydides, who was himself an Athenian, fought, you know, commanded a fleet during the early stages of the Peloponnesian Wars, was banished for arriving so slowly at his target that the mission was irrelevant by the time he got there. I'm always tempted to read the sections about Pericles in Thucydides, which are, you know, early on in the book, as Thucydides appealing to have his banishment overturned, right? Because Pericles gets all the best lines in Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War. If listeners haven't read Pericles' funeral oration, the one that starts, "Fix your eyes upon the greatness of Athens," it's so soaring and so ennobling. And I never read that I don't think, Pericles is ruling Athens. This is a very flattering portrait of someone who, you know, is a mixed blessing for Athens, right? Because while he expands the franchise and institutes certain populist measures that in another light can be seen as democratic measures, it is also Pericles who keeps insisting that war with Sparta is inevitable and Athens needs to be moving against Sparta's allies. So you don't get the Peloponnesian Wars without Pericles. And yet, that doesn't come through quite so clearly in Thucydides' telling, which is a long way around to saying that you know, history, like other forms of art and craft, are influenced by their time and they're influenced by the motives of their writers and artists. And that is true of Thucydides and it's true of Hobbes.
Yeah, now that Sal lets me have a chance to ask a question, let me follow up on that one for a minute because
by all means, fight amongst yourselves, gentlemen.
Yeah. No, one of the issues that you address, I think, and certainly is sort of present concern over the Thucydides trap is that there are so many similarities to the current world and to what Athens and Sparta faced. And I look at that and go, but the world, China may be looking for a multipolar world rather than a unipolar or a duopoly, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, the world that the Athenians and the Spartans did was much smaller, much different in so many ways than what we see. Is and let me just start with a fundamental question. Is what we're looking at in discussing Thucydides, how seriously should we take that as a pattern for the modern world? Or, are there core universal truths that he's revealing? Or it's not a direct parallel, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, at least to me. Now, I'm happy to hear differently. So,
no, I think that's absolutely right. I think this notion of a Thucydides trap is nonsense. It takes one strand in a woven tapestry in which a panoply of human motives and state actions.
And we look like we accidentally lost Corey. So, hey, the joys of live show. We're going to give our call right back. If everybody could just hold on, and you get to hear it ring.
You have reached the guest messaging system. The person you are trying to reach is unavailable. Please leave.
And we have a backup phone number, so if everybody be quiet, patient with us, we will be right with you. So do you want to reformat your question there, Eagle One, while we get Corey back on the line?
Probably. If, for those of you who are listening and you want to know what we're talking about, Corey wrote an article called The Summer of Misreading Thucydides, which appeared in The Atlantic. And then there's another series of articles with our set of articles. Surprise!
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I got cut off and it wouldn't let me dial back in.
Well, it's funny. I thought it was me, and I was like, no, it's not me. It's Corey. She dropped. But hey, we had a backup phone number, so we're right on board. Pick up right where you left off. It's live. That's all right.
Yeah. So this notion that there is one lesson to take out of Thucydides is nonsense. Moreover, I think the notion that – I think Thucydides' own conclusion, which is that Sparta's to blame for this war, is actually a part of his – bias in telling the story. It's actually a part of him trying to cozy up to the leadership of Athens and get his banishment overturned. Because the story that he tells, right, the evolving story of a crisis between Athens and Sparta, where Athens begins to try and chip away at Sparta's alliances, and Sparta gets fed up and resorts to violence in 430 BC. That story goes on for 30 years. So the notion that there's just one lesson you can take from it when he's telling a story about, you know, Sparta is the hegemon. It's a conservative power. And for most of the people of the ancient Greek world, Sparta was a restrained and responsible hegemon. Athens was not, right? Sparta's an oligarchy. There are elements of representative government in it. But Athens is kind of a break from that. It has a much wider level of participation and looks like a dangerous tyrant to Thucydides once he has been banished and once Pericles dies. So, you know, I can think of 10 important lessons to draw out of Thucydides, and none of them are Thucydides' own conclusion. Because the story that he tells is a story of Sparta as a relatively benign hegemon, and Athens as an aggressive imposer, not just a challenger to Sparta, and not just a threat to Sparta's allies, but as, of course, we see in the Melian dialogue, it refuses to permit states to be neutral in this conflict. It's much more ruthless than Sparta in its behavior towards other countries. And if you think about the Mytilene debate early on in the course of the war, where an Athenian ally toys with defecting to Sparta. Even there, Sparta is quite constrained. It takes its sweet time getting there to be helpful, and actually doesn't arrive before Mytilene is forced to surrender. So I think some of the big lessons that come out of Thucydides are about the way that free societies, or societies that in which the public can influence government's decision, might be a better way to say it for the ancient Greek world,
the way that free societies, in the passions of potential conflict, can talk themselves into ruin. Every bad decision that gets made in Thucydides' history of the Peloponnesian Wars, with the sole exception of Pericles' choice to continue to provoke Sparta, every other decision is made by populace goading the public into a reckless choice, whether it is Sparta choosing violence against Athens, whether it is the Athenian public choosing to kill everybody on the island of Milos if they won't become an ally, whether it's the Athenian public choosing to kill everyone in Mytilene because they had the temerity to choose their own allies, right? Like the invasion of Sicily, every bad decision is a decision in which a populist eggs on the crowd. And that strikes me as a much more important lesson for us in our current age than the notion that you know, a rising power is a potential threat to the established peace.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that got my toes tingling when everybody started bringing this up again and more people would read it. Because I don't know how you can, what you can point the thread to, but in popular culture, there's this concept of, Athens, of this great artist, poet, democracy where everybody sits around and they're with their sheets wrapped around them talking about big thoughts. And Sparta's this collection of, high tea, greased up Prussians force marching all over the plains. And it's not really like that. It's different. And there's a reason why the USA is the oldest democratic system running in the world right now. It's because our founders, because of the time and the place, the post-Enlightenment when they were educated, and those that haven't read about the early years of a lot of our founders and how they were educated, whether it's John Adams or any of that group, I encourage people to do so. They were deeply steeped in what we call the classics, many times reading them in Greek and Latin. So when they devised our system of government, they did so with a deep, deep knowledge of what happened to the Athenian Republic, what happened to the Roman Republic, and try to devise a system that had checks and balances to protect this new republic from those things that befell the old, most notably what you brought up, populism. From the beginning of the progressive era, one of my favorite windmills to tilt against is the popular election of senators. I still don't like it. But I'm one of those guys. Talk for a bit, if you can, about besides, I think you're spot on where people just need to take a powder about China, USA, Athens, Sparta. The differential equation is way too complicated for it to be that linear. But talk a little bit more as well about the role of uncontrolled, unchecked populism and how that can compound itself when you have the wrong players at the wrong place. You've kind of touched on that already in Athens, but that is the real story, I think, that you can get from the Peloponnesian War as opposed to try to find a direct line nation-state reaction today.
I think that is exactly right. And my favorite part of Thucydides' Peloponnesian Wars is actually the debate early on in the course of the war over what to do about Mytilene, which is a city-state more in the Athenian alliance, but more independent than others. It was permitted to have its own fleet. They're not wild about supporting Athens in this war that's going on. And they flirt with rebellion. The Athenians sail a fleet to dissuade them of it. Sparta thinks the better of picking up this potential jewel drop. But the real focus of the story is after Mytilene is forced to surrender, Athens has to make a choice about what to do about it, right? And Thucydides tees it up as parallel speeches between two of the Athenian leaders. One is Cleon, who Thucydides describes as the most violent man at Athens, and at that time by far the most powerful with the commons. Cleon and the counterpart speech is from a guy named Diodotus, who is the voice of caution and reason. And one of the things that tickles me so much with so many of the people close to President Trump, the political ideologues close to President Trump, venerating Thucydides, is that it is the elites in Thucydides who are always the voice of caution, reason, and not being too rich and hedging your bets and not running risks with things you can't afford to lose. And so Cleon gives this speech saying that we need to kill everybody on the isle of on the city of Mytilene, because if we don't, our other allies will rebel against us. So we need to make an object lesson of these guys. And even though it was the oligarchs in Mytilene who rebel, you need to kill everybody, even the public, when the public had actually tried to surrender and their leadership had to follow them, not lead them. So he thinks that killing everybody to set an example is what Athens ought to do. And Diodotus comes up with a speech that actually sounds so much like American foreign policy after 1945. He argues that, you know, I'm not appealing to you for mercy. I'm not appealing to you to do the right thing. I am arguing that we should spare all but the direct plotters. We should spare them because the example that it sets is that we will treat with mercy and give you something short of complete destruction. So if a society makes a bad choice, there's a path back. And Diodotus says that this is just good policy because it doesn't force us to fight to the bitter end against everyone, and it also leaves them prosperous enough to pay tribute to us, right? My very favorite passage in this entire speech, I'm looking it up real quickly. Okay, here it is. As long as poverty gives men the courage of necessity or fills them with the ambition which belongs to insolence and pride, and the other conditions of life remain each under the thraldom of some fatal and master passion, so long will the impulse never be wanting to drive men into danger. And so he concludes, again, I'm quoting him, the right course with free men is not to chastise them rigorously when they do rise, but rigorously to watch them before they rise and to prevent their ever entertaining the idea. And once the insurrection is suppressed, to make as few responsible for it as possible. When I read that, I think of the United States rebuilding West Germany and choosing to say that not all Germans are Nazis, and that we can rebuild a German military that isn't the Wehrmacht, and that we can build an international order where people voluntarily pull towards us, and we don't have to enforce everything all the time. And so the difference between a rising China and the United States is that we really do create a liberal order where people opt in, and as a result of that, they are prosperous and safe. And China's not offering that same kind of bargain. They are much more Cleon than they are Diodorus. And so values matter. The behavior of a strong power matters on how much people resist the kind of order they want to put in place. And what I believe is that what I love about Diodotus' speech is that he's arguing that beneficence by the strong is wise policy.
You know, I'm sitting here listening to that and going, you know, Sun Tzu said that in a way, when you always leave a place for your enemy to retreat. That lessens their desire to fight to the death, right? So
exactly.
I'm not sure who came first anymore, but because my knowledge of the 5th century BC is slightly limited, but
what's great about the Mytilene debate, though, is that Cleon wins it in the first round, right? This too is a lesson from Thucydides that populace overreact. And as you guys pointed out, right, there are no institutional constraints on power. That's the big difference between Athenian democracy and our magnificent republic. So there are no institutional constraints. The mob decides to kill everybody on Mytilene. And a day later, after the ship has already been dispatched with that order, a day later is when they reconsider, when they're not in the frenzy of passion and they listen to the beneficent argument and reconsider. And they send a second ship where people man the oars 24 hours, right? They're essentially hot bunking in order to overtake the first ship to get the news to the commander in Mytilene to only kill the rebellious plotters and not the entire society. So there too is the lesson that, that political decisions made in the heat of passion very often bear repenting.
Yeah, but I'm also thinking that of the time. I mean, even the consideration that the Athenians are saying, well, you know, kill them all or not kill them all, given the context of the ways wars were fought in those days, maybe in a larger sense, and certainly, you know, after the Mongols and all that stuff, I mean, it was a tradition to kill everybody. I mean, and enslave their, I mean, maybe I'm just reading too much Conan the Barbarian, but, you know, I'm gonna kill everybody and take the women and children. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, the big thing to me was that they're at least, and they're sitting around their bedsheets, as Sal said, that somebody was raising this issue of, you know, maybe this isn't the best idea to keep killing everybody.
Right, and that's what makes Thucydides timeless, because he actually shows us all sides of a debate. And so if you want to cherry pick the lesson of Thucydides, you could pick 20 great lessons if you take it out of the context that he is trying to show societies dealing with the wrenching challenges of warfare. And one of the beautiful things about Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War is that with the slight caveat of his affection for Pericles, he's fair to every single side of the argument. Right? Like, there are reasons for Cleon to argue these guys are a danger. And as you say, not uncommon to kill everybody in an opposing city. Think of the end of Homer's Iliad. But there is another side to the story, and that other side can be persuasive, even in an ancient world in which practices of warfare were much more barbaric towards civilians than we think about now.
Speaking of cherry picking, you made a really good point that I think needs repeating, because it's kind of like, for those that engage in full combat, a Bible study, it always drives me nuts when somebody will pull a chapter and verse out. I was taught as a young man, and when everybody does that, stop them and go, okay, let's read the five verses before, the five verses after, and let's discuss the context of the quote. That doesn't just apply to biblical things. Other things written in Greek apply as well. And the interesting point you made is about that often quoted line, quote, "The strong do what they will, the weak suffer what they must," unquote. And a lot of people are using that and think they're understanding what was going 180 degrees out of the point that's actually being made. Flesh that out a little bit in the context of what you were just discussing.
That is exactly right. So that passage comes up in the Melian dialogue, which is late in the course of the war. A state that has been neutral, Athens demands tribute from, because Athens is having a really hard time bankrolling this long war. So they demand tribute from Milos, which refuses, right? They say, "We're an independent state. We pose no threat to you. There is no reason for you to do us harm. Leave us in peace." And the Athenians say, "The weak do suffer what they must. The strong do as they will." And they kill everybody on Milos. And it's a shocking moment, even in the context of the story Thucydides is telling. This is shocking. And what is so ironic about people taking that as the lesson out of Thucydides is that this is the inflection point where Athens' doom is sealed, right? This is the point at which they lose any voluntary cooperation by their supposed allies. And soon after, when the invasion of Sicily occurs, Athens' invasion of Sicily, where they send an invasion force and a fleet much larger than they can afford to lose, and they lose it. And when that happens, Athens' allies see the opportunity to begin to rebel, and they do. So Athens' destruction is not simply a function of the invasion of Sicily, but because of the behavior they exhibited, imposed upon Milos, all of their allies choose their moment of weakness, not just to abandon them, but to work against them. So if you think the lesson of Thucydides is this, you know, hard-nosed realist, strong do what they will, weak suffer what they must, you need also to read the passages in which this seals the doom of Athens. That if, in fact, they had made a choice closer to what they make early on with Mytilene, which is, you know, to be sparing and indulgent towards allies even if they don't deserve it, they wouldn't have been subject to attack by all their allies. So the Melian dialogue passage that realists love so much is actually the moment at which Athens not just loses its moral compass, it loses the basis of its strength. It's got an exposed flank because of its unsuccessful invasion of Sicily, and it starts getting chipped away by its own allies. And what, 4 years later, 2 years later, they have to surrender to the Spartans.
Yeah, one of the things, I think it's in your, I'm sorry, certain I must have copied it from your work, says that time and time again, vibrant societies are brought to ruin by angry or enervated publics who ignore the moderately counsel of seasoned, educated elites. And I'm sitting there saying, well, who are the seasoned, educated elites that you're talking about? And is this a plea to the what we now call the deep state to step in and save us from ourselves?
Well, I wasn't trying to draw a grand political conclusion for our time. I was just pointing out that it was kind of ironic that the most populist elements of the ideological wing of the Trump administration, who I think of as populists, are praising Thucydides, when one of the important things to notice in Thucydides is that all of the major decisions that are ruinous are decisions when a moderate elite voice, for example, the king of Sparta, in the initial debate about going to war, the king of Sparta is arguing, we don't need to do this, right? Like, we're a status quo power. We can ignore Athens without peril. And it is the elected, the ithor, the elected kind of pseudo-religious leader who shares power with the king, who whips them on to say, we cannot possibly let our allies be imposed upon. The honor of Sparta is at risk here. He carries the argument Sparta chooses a preventative attack on Athens, right? That's not a great story about populism because it embroils Sparta in a 30-year war they might have avoided had they taken the king's advice. And you see it, we've already talked about the Mytilene example, you see it in Milos, and most importantly, I think you see it in the Athenian discussion about the invasion of Sicily. So Pericles, who Thucydides describes as a populist in one sense in the kinds of reforms he's creating in Athens, which will make it a more demagogic society after he dies in the plague. But the people who come to power subsequently, these are all, you know, smart, sleek, young intellectuals. They're all the students of Socrates, as a matter of fact. If you think about, you know, why Socrates gets sentenced to death, the charge against him is corrupting the youth of Athens. And it happens because it's all Socrates' students who egg Athens on to the invasion of Sicily, which becomes a disaster. And there, the moderate voice, again, it's not a perfect analogy, right? Because Socrates' students, they're clearly elites, right? They're wealthy, educated, young Athenians. But they are the reckless ones. And the voices of moderation actually get played into assisting the disaster, right? So one of the opponents of the invasion, in order to try and shed light on why this might be a bad idea, argues for a much larger invasion force than anybody else. Because what he is trying to do is get people to realize we can't afford to lose this much. And so if this is what the invasion takes, we ought to forego the invasion. And instead, Athenians become persuaded by his argument. And they send an invasion force larger than they can afford to lose. It's not a perfect analogy. It just struck me as funny that in so many ways, the populists in the Trump administration haven't read Thucydides carefully enough to see that very often the populists who bring about the ruin of their societies by persuading the public to do things that are riskier than the more experienced, the deep state crowd of Athens and Sparta would have advised.
I don't want to go ahead and dig in to have you show too much angle on what you're working for with your book on Anglo-American hegemonic transition. That's a mouthful. But going back to Sir Richard's preface in my little 4x6 handy book that I like so much, in the extended quote I did earlier, he mentions Gibbon. And of course, when you look at mid-20th century and early 20th century Great Britain, they were in that transition period where they were the preeminent power. And there was this obsession with Gibbon's work, the rise and the fall of the Roman Empire and the parallel of the Roman to the British Empire. And everybody read it. Everybody referenced it. And you've even seen in the course of the last few decades, you know, people try to say, you know, well, U.S. followed the same pattern as Great Britain, et cetera, and so forth. And I find it interesting that, you know, here we are not everybody is talking about rise and fall of the Roman Empire, but we're going back to the Peloponnesian War. When people are trying to find a reference, because I guess when you reach the when you actually grab the brass ring, you know, kind of like the dog finally catching the car, you know, now what do you do with it? Now that you're there, you just become, you pick your belly button over how are we going to lose it? Because you inevitably do. You know, if people were looking for that deep kind of reference, is looking at Thucydides in the Peloponnesian War as helpful as maybe looking at Gibbon's work, or should it just be more of an a la carte, be better read of the works of great people to try to figure out and get some hints about what you might want to do coming up?
Okay, so you guys may not know that I'm a desperate baseball fan, which is to say I'm so grateful for that big, fat one, slow and in the middle of the strike zone. Because it's certainly true that we should all be better read. But I love that you make the comparison to Gibbon. In the book that I, Safe Passage, that I have coming out from Harvard in the fall, I got really curious about this question with all the talk about the rise of China and what does it mean for the United States as the dominant power, the lawgiver and enforcer in the international order. What does it mean? And can it be peaceful? There is only one peaceful transition of power between an established hegemon and a rising challenger, and that's Britain and the United States in the 19th century. And I was astonished that nobody smarter than me had already written a book explaining why that transition was peaceful. And so I tried to do that with a history that starts in 1823 and ends in 1945. It starts in 1823 because that's the Monroe Doctrine, which some people don't know was actually a British proposal to us for us to bilaterally police the Western Hemisphere from continental European influence and colonization as Spain's empire crumbled. And I work forward from there through eight different inflection points. Crises that might have resulted in conflict but don't between Britain and the United States. So the Oregon boundary crisis of 1843, why the British don't recognize the Confederacy during the Civil War, the period of the 1870s when you have westward expansion in the United States and both societies really kind of choose their national narrative. The Venezuelan debt crises in 1895 and 1905, Spanish-American War, World War I, the Washington Naval Accords, I know a subject near and dear to you guys' hearts, and then World War II. And the explanation, I think, for why this is peaceful is that in the 1870s, the U.S., because of the westward expansion, comes to think of ourselves in imperial terms. And Britain in the same time frame, because of its expansion of voting rights, comes to be more fully democratic. So what we look like to each other is similar to each other and different from everybody else. And that sense of common values, of being different than everybody else, creates the space for policy compromises. So values expand the space of political compromise and crisis, and the two societies come to think of themselves as fundamentally similar. By the end of the 1895 Venezuelan crisis, war between the U.S. and Britain looks like fratricide. And so, in my judgment, hegemonic powers create the international order. Once they're strong enough to be able to dictate their rules, the hegemon creates a macrocosm of its domestic political order. And the reason the United States is such a weird outlier as a hegemon and why I think American dominance of the international order is likely to be long-lasting, irrespective of the challenges a rising China poses for us, is that we did create the international order in our domestic political image. That is, voluntary alliances, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, and we created an international order that rewards individual liberty, representative government, and free markets. And the states that have chosen to practice those, we have assisted in the provision of security for, and they are the strongest, most prosperous states in the international order. And they have benefited by rules we created that didn't just benefit us. And I think that's a really enduring, successful strategy. And I don't see a challenge. As Frank Fukuyama argued in his End of History, I don't see a sustained challenge on any other ideological basis that can overturn that.
Well, it's let me talk about that for a minute, because China's view of the world is so different than ours, in the sense that they China-centric and so wanting to be what they were before the Opium Wars, where the rest of the world paid tribute to them, that and their current state of thinking seems to be, because they didn't participate in the making of the modern world, you know, that they somehow want all the rules to be rewritten, I can say that. You know, is that become the outline problem? I mean, the system works for everybody else. It has worked for them, but now they want to start changing the rules in the middle of the game.
It's a fantastic question, and I think it's the million-dollar question of war and peace in our time. To restate it slightly, can China continue to rise without liberalizing? Because a liberal China is one that will fit very well into the order. But if China can continue to be an outlier in which prosperity does not lead to political liberalization, then I think they're very likely to be a serious challenger to the American order, because they're not going to accept the rules that we have created. They don't believe that small states ought to have a veto over their action, or that rules that govern others need to govern them. And if China continues to succeed, the United States will have to enforce the order against them. The good news is we will have a lot of help in enforcing that order for the reasons we talked about a little bit ago. But you'll probably have to. I do not believe that if China, as currently politically constituted, continues to grow more prosperous and powerful in the international order, I do not believe that can happen without war against the United States, because at some point they're going to want to test their luck. My favorite political scientist is an Australian named Jeffrey Blaney, who argues that the cause of war is a state thinking they can win, right? It's actually just as simple as that. And if the Chinese believe they can overturn the international order, and we either fail to have the strength of arms to prevent it or fail to have the will to prevent it, we will be looking at a very different international order, one that gets redrawn along Chinese rules, and that the United States is not likely to enjoy being part of very much.
And I don't think that's a world that anybody wants to be part of, besides maybe those in China wanting to do it. I always thought that, and again, I'm a closet optimist, believe it or not, that the thousands of children of the Chinese elite who come to the U.S., Canada, and some of the other Western nations for higher education, that some of those things will sink in, and as a net positive, hopefully, will lead us.
I agree with that.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I absolutely agree with that. And it's not just them, but it's Chinese mothers who can't get safe baby milk. And it's people whose houses get confiscated to put high-speed trains in, right? Like, we're so good at identifying all of the, you know, problems of our own system, and we actually tend to project all of our advantages and none of our difficulties onto our adversaries.
Exactly. Everybody should hug their American passport when they get a chance, even during the bad days. And Corey, what an incredibly fast and enjoyable hour. Thank you very much. I know you've had a very hectic schedule, and we were able to shoehorn you in here. Really appreciate your time today. I'm also looking forward to seeing the fall, your book coming out from Harvard on the Anglo-American hegemonic transition. Now, I stalk you on Twitter, which if everybody wants to keep following, it's at KORISCHAKE. If the listener would like to keep track of you there, where are some other places they can keep an eye open for the work that either you're producing or you find interesting?
So I'm a contributing editor at The Atlantic magazine, and I have the privilege of writing from time to time for War on the Rocks, and I record a podcast with David Sanger, Rosa Brooks, and David Roskopf called Deep State Radio.
Yes, highly recommend it all. And I encourage my listeners to give Corey a read when you have an opportunity and to listen to. We're a big fan of podcasts for obvious reasons. And I hope you have a safe trip, Corey, and I look forward to the opportunity to talk to you again down the road.
Thank you so much for the privilege of this conversation.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Goddamn.